Hello and welcome to the Greatest Britons. Today's date is March the 13th. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today we are going to be looking at the Duke of Wellington, Arthur Wellesley. And this was originally produced as a segment in the Arian Britannia series back last year in November. We are going to talk about one of the greatest Britons, once again in our series here of Greatest Britons, and that is Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington, also known as the Iron Duke, who was a fantastic military man and also a rather wonderful Prime Minister. And he was a stout Christian chap that put principles before all else. And I know that you've admired the man for quite some time, Max. So do you want to tell us a little bit about Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington?
Yeah, it's he's somebody who was born into an aristocratic Anglo-Irish family. He was born in 1769. He's somebody who built up a reputation over time of being a very efficient military leader. And he tended to drift in life, and I know that his mother was worried about whether he's ever going to actually make anything of himself, but he eventually secured a commission into the British Army. This was in 1787, so he was 18 at the time, and became an ensign, which is like a second lieutenant. From that point onwards, he began to climb up through the ranks. And some of that climbing up through the ranks was done on the basis of merit and the fact that he was promoted, and other steps up when he was climbing up that ladder were as a result of the ability at the time for wealthy people to be able to buy themselves promotions, and he did that. So he purchased the step up from captain to major, and in the same year then also purchased the step up from major to lieutenant colonel. This was in 1719 when he was aged 21. So at the age of 21, he was an officer in the British Army that was of quite a senior rank, and so he then had the opportunities that would normally have only been available to a much older man who had served a long period of service and who had proven himself in the field of battle, and who would therefore have justified having the promotions just purely on the basis of merit. But the Duke of Wellington purchased, as I say, some of these increases. But he was then promoted to colonel in 1796 at the age of 27, and so that put him in a situation where he would then have been in charge of a regiment of that probably would have been something like 2,000 to 2,500 men. And it then meant that he had the opportunity to prove himself and to do things that wouldn't have been available to other people of at the same age if they were born into poorer families. And, you know, you can say that that's unfair. That means that he had an unfair leg up. And to some extent, I would have to admit that that's correct. But it's no more of a leg up than the sort of people who join the police, having gone to university and having got a degree, who then go on these accelerated promotion courses where they go from nowhere to inspector within a matter of just a few years, whereas in the past police officers were expected to join as a constable and then to work their way up. But I think that there are some justifiable criticisms that people shouldn't be able to do that sort of thing. But there are also some justifiable arguments as to why it might actually, in certain circumstances, be beneficial to do that. And I think in the case of the Duke of Wellington, it was actually beneficial because he appeared to be somebody who functioned very efficiently at whatever rank he was in. And and just seemed to go from strength to strength. And so he...
Can I just ask a question there, Max? I'm just thinking about this rank thing. If you had purchased a rank like that and then you were to not do very well at your job, was it possible for them to still sack you?
Oh, yes. It would still be possible for you to lose that rank. Yeah, that's right. And so that would then just be whatever you pay, but it'd just be money down the drain.
Can I just add something else there as well? At that time, we didn't have the big problem with usury that we have now. And I don't think Jews were able to buy themselves into places like that because they would have to take oaths, which they weren't actually able to do at that time. So if somebody did have money, it would have been money that wasn't earned off the back of usury. It would have been wealth that had been earned off the back of innovation and being hardworking. And that would have been putting your money where your mouth is. You know, maybe that's where that saying comes from. I don't know. Or maybe it's to do with bets. But you would be putting your money where your mouth is and investing in a better career, I would suggest. A good thing.
Yes. Yes. But Arthur Wellesley, he then took part in a number of military campaigns. Some of them were in the Netherlands. Others of them were in India. And he was involved in the Fourth Anglo-Mysore War and the Battle of Seringapatam, which is a bit of a mouthful. And he served in India for quite some time, all the way through to around about 1804, when he then returned to the UK, having been appointed Major General prior to that, and having accumulated a fortune of in those days, £42,000, which would, by today's standards, be worth something like about £1.8 million. So he had made himself quite a wealthy man by virtue of the military service that he'd been able to undertake, had got himself promoted to a fairly senior rank in the British Army, and upon his return to the UK, had the opportunity then of meeting Lord Nelson. And this was around about the same time as Trafalgar. In fact, Trafalgar took place 7 weeks after the Duke of Wellington met Lord Nelson whilst he was in the UK, and he then went on during the Napoleonic Wars to take part in the Peninsula Campaign, where again he distinguished himself well and was promoted to Field Marshal, and this led to Allied forces, and he led Allied forces to victory against the French Empire at the Battle of Vittoria in 1813. And following that, Napoleon was initially defeated, and Napoleon was then exiled to the island of Elba. And during the period that happened, then the Duke of Wellington became the British ambassador to France. And at that point then was granted a dukedom. So that's when he became the Duke of Wellington. But then Napoleon managed to escape from Elba and went back to France, managed to gain control of France again. And so these Napoleonic Wars then took on that then sort of rose up again for a second time. And there were the 100 days, as they call it, during 1815, when Napoleon again was trying to assert his empire and gain power in Europe. And during that period, that was the period then when the Duke of Wellington was then sent over to Europe to help to fight to contain Napoleon. And the upshot of it was that the Duke of Wellington took part in one of the greatest land battles of that period, which was the Battle of Waterloo. And the Battle of Waterloo took place I think that Waterloo is actually in Belgium. I'm not quite sure of the country. I think it is Belgium. But anyway, it's that sort of area of the sort of Low Countries. But the Battle of Waterloo took place where Wellington was commanding the British Army, where Marshal Blücher was commanding the Prussian army, which were in alliance with Britain at the time, and where Napoleon had his French forces. And the battle was one that didn't look where success didn't appear to be guaranteed right from the outset. It did appear that Napoleon was getting the upper hand to begin with. And the difference in style is that is that Wellington was very skilled and had become very skilled at defensive strategies, and Napoleon was very skilled at the opposite, which was in offensive skills. And one of the things that Napoleon did was he was well known for being prepared to delegate to his subordinates so that they would have greater freedom in the field of battle, and so therefore could be more maneuverable in terms of making their attacks. The battle raged in a way which is quite complex to try and convey in this kind of a medium, where this is a podcast and you're really just listening to my voice. So I won't try and go into any great detail about the strategy involved here, other than to say that there were a number of differences that were shown up in terms of the tactics on the battlefield used by the different forces. And one of the things that the Duke of Wellington had used to good effect and had helped to kind of perfect within the British Army was the tactic of using several ranks of infantry soldiers in order to maintain a repetitive volleys of fire. And this is quite keenly and quite sort of clearly illustrated in the classic film Zulu, where the officer concerned there defends the outpost at Rorke's Drift against the Zulu attack by having soldiers where they're arranged in three ranks, with one rank kneeling, one rank standing, and the rank at the back standing on straw bales or boxes so that they can fire over the heads of the standing soldiers. And then having each rank of soldiers firing in turn. So the front rank fires, then whilst they're reloading, the second rank fires, and then whilst they're reloading, the third rank fires, and then you go back to the front rank firing again. And there's the famous scene in the film Zulu where the officer concerned is calling out, you know, front rank fire, middle rank fire, rear rank fire, and these constant volleys of gunshot are then causing the Zulus to are basically killing the Zulus before the Zulus can reach the British soldiers. And this is a form of fire that was developed by the British Army and was not copied by other armies on the continent. So as far as the French were concerned, the French tended to have their soldiers march forward and to fire in a less coordinated fashion, where the soldier would march forward, stop, aim, fire, then reload, and then march forward again, stop, aim, load, and fire. But they wouldn't be firing in volleys. There would be continuous fire from the French forces, but it wouldn't have the same impact as a volley of gunshot hitting the troops on the other side. It would just be individual soldiers would be hit by musket fire and they would fall. Now, the other tactic employed, if I just go back to the three rank system that I spoke about in the film Zulu, that was a tactic that was used in defensive situations where British soldiers were intending to attack. The tactic they tended to use there was to wait until the enemy forces were very, very close to them. And part of the reason for this was firstly that they were fighting with muskets, which weren't very accurate. And so the muskets wouldn't have been accurate over anything more than about 100 yards. So they had to wait until the enemy forces were within musket range or accurate musket range. But then they also employed the tactic of holding their fire until the enemy forces were almost on top of them, and so the point was that they would then fire. Every British soldier would fire a volley into the advancing enemy, and then immediately with bayonets attached, charge into the enemy and get involved in hand-to-hand combat. And it was well recognised in those days that the British soldiers did fight with greater aggression and ferocity in those kind of situations in hand-to-hand fighting, and it was those kind of tactics that proved to be superior during the Battle of Waterloo. And the upshot of it was that there were quite a lot of manoeuvres of the troops on the ground, and one of Napoleon's great skills was his ability to manoeuvre his troops on the ground to such an extent that he would trick the enemy commanders into attacking where Napoleon's troops were had numerical superiority, rather than them attacking where Napoleon's troops were in the minority. And so he tended to outmaneuver them in that respect and outpsych them and get them to make forced errors of that kind. But because of the dogged resistance that had been provided by the British soldiers in fighting in these ways and employing the tactics of volley fire and the tactics of using bayonet charges, that they were able to wear down the French and eventually prevail at the end of the day. And so the Battle of Waterloo was probably the decisive battle in eventually ending Napoleon's reign. I think there was another battle that followed it, the name of which I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but there were another battle that followed. But then eventually Napoleon was again exiled to the Isle of Elba again. And as far as the Duke of Wellington was concerned, he returned to Britain and was in the same way that Lord Nelson was heralded as a national hero. And he then, in the latter part of his life, was involved in politics. I think he had stood as a candidate for the Conservative Party, and he had been elected on two occasions to the position of Prime Minister. And in fact, I think, you know, some people have joked about Boris Johnson perhaps being the shortest lived Prime Minister of Britain if he doesn't win this next general election. But Duke of Wellington was the Prime Minister for a period of just under a month on one of the occasions. I don't know quite what the circumstances were there, but that's the case. But he then was promoted to the House of Lords eventually, but remained the head of the British Army right through to the day that he died. And so he's somebody who came from quite a privileged background, who used the privilege to advance him, to give himself accelerated promotion through the army. So some of his promotions, as I say, were as a result of him purchasing those promotions. Others were based on merit, but he had spent a long period of years going through a kind of apprenticeship, both in on the continent in the earlier campaigns that had taken place with regard to the Napoleonic Wars, but then going over to India and being involved in some of the battles for to extend the British Empire and to extend the Raj in India, before returning again to Europe to use the skills that he had learned during those early campaigns to good effect in eventually defeating Napoleon, who was renowned as being one of the great military strategists at the time. And so as far as Arthur Wellesley is concerned, he lived a very full life. From what I can make out, he married twice. He was regarded as a bit of a philanderer in terms of having affairs with women, and tended to have a penchant for intelligent women.
Yeah, the first love that he had, I did read, I think it might have been Kitty, the one that he ended up with sort of all of his life, even though he fell out with. She actually turned him down at first, but either because he didn't have enough money or he didn't have a high enough status. And that might have been what encouraged him to buy his first. Yeah, buy the first one.
First time, that's right.
Yeah, it might have been that inspired him to buy that first rank, whatever it was, before he became colonel.
Yes, I do recall that now, yes.
But sorry, do continue.
Well, actually, I've pretty much got to the end of what I was going to present there, which I think just really shows that, you know, he, as I say, he came from a well-to-do family, got some of his promotions on the basis of merit, got some of his promotions on the basis that he was able to buy them, which effectively gave him accelerated promotion through the ranks of the British Army, arrived in a situation where he was then a fairly senior officer. But at each stage, he performed well and he discharged his duties to the satisfaction of his superiors. And so it wasn't a matter that he was promoted above his station by virtue of the fact that he got money. It was a matter that his promotion was accelerated and he was actually adequate and capable of doing the job that he got the accelerated promotion to, which is a good thing. But again, he was somebody who studied battlefield tactics and had learned that these tactics of maintaining continuous volley fire in defence and of having volley fire and bayonet charges in attack were the two key sort of tactics that he used there. He also was one of the very first military strategists to focus a lot of attention on logistics to make sure that the troops that he had always had secure supply lines, and so that they were always in a situation where they had adequate amounts of food, had adequate amounts of ammunition, etc., and adequate amounts of water, so that they would be able to maintain their efficiency. And that again was another factor involved in his success as well.
So he's very good at planning ahead. I was going to say about these, about when he was out there in India, I mean, his services to the British Empire were, you know, pretty immense, really. That's why he got all that money there in the beginning. I mean, he put down, this Dunda Waf insurgency, which was basically, the Hindus had their own empire, and that was just I guess it must have been to the east or to the south of where the British Empire was. And he ended up being the main man that put an end to this empire. And there were quite a few big insurgencies there. And there was one bit that I found particularly interesting, this Dunda Waf insurgency, who was a really formidable foe. And it says, Dunda was killed during the clash. His body was discovered and taken to the British camp, tied to a cannon. With this victory, Wellesley's campaign was concluded. British authority had been restored. Wellesley, with command of four regiments, had defeated Dundar's larger rebel force, along with Dundar himself, who was killed in the final battle. Wellesley then paid for the future upkeep of Dundar's orphaned son. And I picked that out because I thought that shows you how honourable he was.
Yeah, that's really something in those days, yeah.
Oh, well, that's a tradition that goes back thousands of years. You know, if you kill the general or somebody high up, you have to pay for the upkeep of the son. You know, it's just a tradition. And another bit that I picked out, once he was actually prime minister, the Jews were kept out of parliament. And one of the reasons why they were kept out of parliament is because of the oath that you had to take in order to join. So they were lobbying the government to make a change to allow them into parliament. And it took them 35 years, I think. Eventually, they managed to get a government in power that were willing to change this law. But first off, they started doing it. Wellington was actually prime minister. Wellington opposed the Jewish Civil Disabilities Repeal Bill, and he stated in Parliament on 1st of August 1833 that England is a Christian country and a Christian legislature, and that the effect of this measure would be to remove that peculiar character. The bill was defeated 104 votes to 54, but the Jews continued to push the bill, and in 1858 they finally got their way and a Rothschild was allowed into Parliament. That's what it was all about. So he was aware of the Jews. He was aware of what would happen if the Jews were allowed to take power, basically, as a politician. And Christianity was obviously important to him, because what that was, the oath itself, it doesn't give you the full oath in Wikipedia, but the oath itself was to keep to Christian laws and to keep the country under Christian laws. It wasn't just that it was Christian God that they were, you know, the oath was taken to. So I thought that was interesting as well. And obviously he's the guy that came up with the Wellington boot, which he invented.
Yes.
And he would wear them all the time. And he had distinctive clothing that he would wear, white trousers and black boots. and an incredibly intelligent man. And at one stage, he was rude about his troops, and that was, I think, it was because they started looting and badly behaving after one battle, and he actually called them scum of the earth for doing that. And again, which shows you just what an honourable man he was. And then later on, because they'd fought so well, he said, well, these were great fighters, and they just lost their discipline at that moment. So he was obviously very keen on upholding standards of chivalry, standards of honour, whilst fighting, and in a good position to be made into prime minister. You know, he'd seen a lot. He'd fought for his country. He'd done great things for the British Empire. You know, very interesting character.
And the other thing as well is that lots of his troops very often mention about the fact that he would actually be in the thick of the battle. He was not the kind of general who would stand back and command from a distant height where he was perfectly safe. He would actually be riding around on a horse with an entourage of about 40 people who were, consisted of his staff officers and consisted of people who were the the messengers who would take his orders to sort of take ride or run to the subordinate officers, so they would know what they were supposed to do next, etc. And so placed himself in at considerable risk, and in one of the earlier battles he received a musket ball injury to his knee as well, I recall, and so he's the sort of person who was a great patriot, and another person from British history who was a great patriot, who was nationalistically inclined, who who recognised that the culture in this country was dependent upon the nature of the people who were able to exercise the sort of right to vote, etc. And it's surprising, the more you learn about the great people of the past and the people that have made significant contributions to the building of this country and to the advancement of this country, just how many of them are people who, if they were today, if they were to be living today, would be racial nationalists rather than the sort of wet liberal left types that fill the ranks of the majority of our politicians nowadays.
They are an inspiration to us all. They certainly are. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back on Monday with more Greatest Britons for you, where we will be looking at First Baron Robert Baden Powell.